She's to sick bay. The doctor should look at it as soon as possible.
It is the way in which we propagate our species. Please demonstrate how this is accomplished.
So, what's next?
Hello, and welcome to Casual Trek, a Star Trek recap and ranking podcast brought to you by Nerd and Tie and for fancy adventure to adult lechery. I'm Charlie Etheridge Nunn, a writer and a fan of the trophy role-playing games.
And I'm Miles Reed Lobato, a science fiction writer and a fan of the paranoia role-playing game. And also, I roll a +5 to my procrastination.
Ah, nice. Yes, I unfortunately have increased my ruin to 4 out of 6, it feels like, at the moment. So I am beset by ungodly plagues. But we're not here to talk about my deteriorating state. Instead, normally, we would talk about 3 episodes of Star Trek based around a theme. But as we're both quite busy, and I'm rather ill, I'm taking this as an opportunity to talk about my recent experiences with the Star Trek Adventures role-playing game. Now, Modiphius have, in my other kind of free pursuit as a RPG journalist, I was asked if I wanted to have a review copy of the Star Trek Adventures 2nd Edition starter set. So we will be talking about a review copy that was provided, and as such, obviously that should be taken in mind whether or not I was bribed with dice and flimsy tokens. We'll get into flimsy tokens soon. But yeah, before we do that though, Miles, what non-Star Trek thing have you been enjoying since we last spoke?
Well, yesterday my lovely wife and editor Rihanna and I watched what is now, I think, a comfort watch, which is the 2-part TV movie of the Stephen King novella, The Langoliers.
Oh yes, my God.
The one with the really bad giant flying balls with teeth.
Yeah, yeah, the evil tribbles.
The evil tribbles. It's fun. It's surprisingly sedate because it's, you know, again, as a Doctor Who fan, I can always applaud when a show decides to spend half its runtime just walking around like some empty location clearly being filmed at 5 o'clock in the morning and just calling it deserted. It has Dean Stockwell, and, you know, Dean Stockwell is always a fun actor to watch in anything he's generally in. And yeah, it's not Maximum Overdrive where you can literally taste the cocaine while watching the film. But in terms of, okay, this is a Stephen King joint, it's not too bloody or gory, so I think it's one you can kind of just generally watch. And not for a horror experience, but like in a weird kind of Twilight Zone-y kind of ambience. And yeah, it's fun. It's dumb fun.
Yeah, as someone that's been doing a lot of kind of reading through all of the Stephen King books that I haven't before, to kind of then listen to the Just King Things episodes, I have been tempted at some points to watch the varied Stephen King adaptations, because there are some fun ones, and there are some Langoliers.
Then there's Langoliers, which isn't great, but it's not, I don't think it's as terrible as its reputation gives it. It just, it's one of those ones where they clearly didn't have the technology. The trouble with Stephen King is that he does tend to go for that strange cosmic horror in a way that you can perfectly describe in a book, but when you try and visually realize it, it just kind of falls apart.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, shit, maybe that's where Lovecraft's whole I'm too lazy to describe things actually works in his favour for that kind of thing. Because I admit, I generally mock the old racist. Okay, oh, really? Oh, it's an indescribable thing. But yeah, maybe King set himself a challenge that can't really be matched well in film without looking bad or hokey. Because sometimes you look at the monsters that he's got and go, like, in my imagination, this can be spooky, the way you've described it. In reality, it's going to look rubbish.
At the same time, I think it's good that we've never had a proper cinematic adaptation of Lovecraft's At the Mountains of Madness. Because albino penguins sound terrifying when you describe them, and they look weird in either the ING Colbard Ian Edgington comic book adaptation or the manga adaptation, which I read recently by Go Tanabe. But you worried that you're sitting watching in a film and they come across the sightless albino penguins, and you're just kind of worried that you're just going to lose your general audience right there, because
they're just going to laugh.
Because penguins look inherently comical.
Yeah. Yeah, one day I need to rewatch for Langoliers. It was, you know, as you say, not terrible, just terrible enough.
It's decent.
Yeah.
And Charlie, what non-Star Trek thing have you been enjoying?
Well, we'll talk about an RPG based on a science fiction license. So I'm going to say about a different RPG based upon a science fiction license, which is Alien: The Role-Playing Game. This is by Free League Publishing, who do a lot and some quite fancy productions. Now, when I first saw that there was an Alien role-playing game, it was I was like, yeah, whatever. And then I actually saw it in person at Dragon Meet, and the kid that saw it at an irresponsibly young age got very excited, and I used all my money from the bring and buy that day to get the core rulebook, the screen, the adventure, all sorts of stuff, and got very excited. And I've run like a demo of it, but I'm currently a player in a friend's game, and it's something rather special. Now, I know what at least one of the other players listens to this show. So there is someone else that can prove this exists. So our friend James, or Zippy, who runs it, has never seen an Alien film. Amazing. Amazing. So I only found that out when we started playing the game. And I've made a grizzled old company lawman who was a bit of a sheriff out on the frontier, who was betrayed by his best friend, who's now run off to some corporation somewhere, and he's basically perpetually a couple of days from retirement. I've made this guy knowing that he's probably going to die. He's very observant and all right as a shot, but not good at most other things. And Zippy asked me, you know, make the guy you're hunting as a backup character. Just
quick question.
Yeah.
Do you say good as a shot or good with a shot? Because knowing you, he could either be an incurable alcoholic or a crack shot.
I mean, both then. If we're going for that, then both. The thing is, the adventure itself with myself, Sheriff Dan Trufant, and we've got a medical droid, and we've got, you know, a more corporate cargo hand guy who's helping out. We're all just doing a cargo run, basically. It's fine. And we're on a station. We're in a kind of a bit of a bar, and a ship crashed into it. And we had disastrous stuff to go. I was like, oh, are there going to be aliens in this craft? It's like, no, there aren't any aliens in the craft. And we've now got some time to kill before we're doing our cargo exchange. And there are some Marines that are stuck here because of the crash and all that. And there's this park, and there are some dodgy looking shenanigans. So we stumbled around the park, tried hiding near some guy that was hidden in a hedge, and got mistaken for people that were out dogging by some guards, who then we had to try and talk our way past at one point. And there's something weird going on, possibly with the plants or with pollen or something, that seems to have people oddly inebriated.
Charlie, before we go further.
Yeah.
For the benefit of our American listeners.
Go on.
Can you explain dogging?
Just sex in a public park. just generally fairly random. Oh yeah, look, here's a dogging hotspot. Anything like that. Yeah, Trash Feature did a whole episode on dogging, which, yeah, great. But yes, so we are, I want to say four sessions in, we have not seen a xenomorph yet. We are not aware that xenomorphs exist. I kind of want it to carry on. I'm amazed by it so far, going, okay, so he's not seen any alien movies and we've not seen a xenomorph. Is there one? what's going on here? And it's beautiful. I want him to not see an alien film, at least, at the very least, until the campaign's done. I want him to remain pure.
I can't help but think of the Sesame Street Kids book. There is a monster at the end of this book. Mm. And I just wanted to find out that the xenomorph was the friends he made along the way.
Yeah, I mean, maybe. Or maybe, like, he read the core book enough that he's done stuff. Like, he knows the corporate side of it and seems to be very much on that. And he's aware of it all. Like, he's a good GM. But, yeah, I'm just fascinated by this. And I know that if I'm feeling well enough tomorrow, it's my own group's weekly session, and I'm starting Alien with them. And I'm certain, even if I'm ill and unable to make it to that to tomorrow night's game, I am probably going to introduce a xenomorph sooner than him. And it's, yeah, I just, like, if he's listening to this, I say all of that with love. And for Ben, who does listen and has kindly provided us funds to talk about Dax previously, yeah, you get this, right? This is all with love, but wow, so bizarre. Anyway, because I could rave about this campaign and how odd it's been endlessly, and I am here to talk about a different campaign thing. Let's move on. So I'm someone that has run role-playing games since 93. I've written about role-playing games for quite a while now, and even wrote for role-playing games a few times, including recently the Spriggs and Kindling zine for the Carved from Brindlewood stuff. So I've got quite a quite a CV RPG wise. I don't actually know much about you and RPGs. Where are you coming to RPGs from?
Okay, so I think there was a brief time of trying to get like an advanced Dungeons & Dragons game together with some friends of friends that fell apart quickly.
Hmm.
The first time I properly played an RPG, a role-playing game, was 2004, when I spent my summer in the States, where I met my future wife in person after we've been like talking online for the first time. And her and her college roommates and friends had a regular gaming group. And so the first time I played, I they would meet every Saturday and play for like 3 to 4 hours, because there was a lot of blather. There's a lot of joking, there's a lot of references, and there's a lot of combat. And so I played on and off characters, originally for D&D 3.5. Then one time I played a one-off character in Rifts. I briefly tried to get in a gaming group in Brighton, where we played the Ghostbusters D6 for a couple of sessions. Wow. And Champions, which ended badly because I think there was all kind of very much difference in tone. Whereas I think the DM wants a much more kind of grounded kind of superhero thing. And I was playing the mod. Ah. Who was basically Britain's attempt at a super soldier kind of Captain Britain kind of thing, except I left that and basically became a superpowered mod, like dispensing justice on my Vespa.
Wow.
And I've played some Pathfinder. I played on and off. I'm currently in a semi-regular game on Discord with Rihanna and frequent guest in the show, Celeste. We're playing Kids with Brooms, which is a more narrative-based kind of kids at magical school kind of thing. There's a lot of Arthurian shit. And it takes place in Avalon, Wisconsin, which is a real place. And that is the Avalon of British myth. And I am playing the current descendant of King Arthur. Who, upon graduating British magic school at 16, immediately got packed off to Avalon, Wisconsin, and now has to take the last 2 years of American high school, where you graduate at 18 in the US. So my character is pissed because, you know, he wants to go to college, he wanted to party and get laid, and now he's having to retake school after graduating. So, and again, I'm playing someone who's very much like a I'm playing a mod again because, you know, I'm from Brighton. And he's, I in my head, he visually looks like a like Malcolm McDowell in the film If.
Right.
And so my character is hasn't told anyone he's the descendant of King Arthur. And I'm basically just trolling everyone I can because I can get away with it.
Wow.
The first thing I did was pick a fight with like the biggest and toughest guy in the school to assert my dominance.
Of course,
and,
of course.
And then I immediately started macking on his girlfriend because again, my character just gives no shits. My character is just like, I'm just going to make trouble for the system because I think the monarchy is bullshit to begin with. And that's the mindset my character, my character's mindset, which is, I am apparently the King of England. I believe in the judicious abolishment of hereditary monarchy to begin with. So I'm basically playing an anarchist.
Okay, good. Good. Yeah, sounds like causing some drama, causing a bit of a stir there.
So pretty much. Good.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I was accidentally bought Vampire the Masquerade when I was 13.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
Thinking it was a card game, because I'd got into Marvel Overpower, because comics, then Magic, and then Vampire the Eternal Struggle, which was the renamed version of Jihad, which was the Vampire the Masquerade CCG.
I wonder why they changed the name.
I know. And yeah, I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't have any D10s. So I had torn up bits of paper numbered 1 to 10 and some hands. It didn't go well. And then a little bit later, my family were going around a castle, as my dad would occasionally drag us around castles. There are a bunch of them around here. And I was just having this lovely time, and I was reading Inquest magazine in the car on the way there and on the way back. They were doing top 10 RPGs, and the number one was inevitably Advanced Dungeons and Dragons. And I was like, ooh, mix these things, like going on a lovely walk. Ooh. And of course, AD&D itself isn't like that. You know, you're murdering things to get XP and money to murder things better and so on. But there is exploration. There can be world building and some interesting things going on there. So I kind of went from there. But because we started with a different system, and from AD&D, there was a new game called Alternity that was the same company that did AD&D, but it was sci-fi. I was like, ooh, I'll check out their sci-fi game. And their settings for it, like the system was fine. Character creation was a slog. The system was quite nice, but the settings, they had an X-Files setting called Dark Matter, which was really good fun. Like all the conspiracies, all of that, but you're a proper organization that is the X-Files rather than, you know, a little bit of the FBI. Star Drive, which was a kind of frontier space. Like there were these ways of getting to this faraway bit of space called the Verge, and it broke. And 111 years later, we've got it back up. But that bit of space it kept going. Like, they've had 111 years without the core worlds dealing with their bullshit and vice versa. So it's, what are these societies like after they've been left alone for a while? And both were really nice, really good. And yeah, at the moment, though, I've, well, just finished Star Trek Adventures. And this year we've got Alien on the slate and probably Public Access, which is at, like, nostalgic analog horror, the kind of a horror RPG, but with video VHS grain on it.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah, you play people that were kids in the 80s and are currently 20-somethings in the early aughts, and you were all fans of a Public Access channel called TV Odyssey, only it doesn't exist anymore. And people can track down occasionally these VHS tapes, which are weird. They can only be viewed at night for some reason. Something with the magnetic tape is weird like that.
This sounds perfectly normal.
Yeah, yeah. And because you're all friends from a forum, you've all gone back to the hometown of Deep Lake to find what happened to the TV station and find more of the tapes. And of course, horrors ensue. So, yeah, they did a slightly shorter campaign version called the Skinny Jeans edition of Public Access. So that's definitely something I want to give a go to. But at the moment, I've ran Star Trek Adventures, and it isn't my first ever Star Trek RPG. I ran the Last Unicorn Games version, which was a nice book. I can't remember how long ago it was, but it's a very long time ago that it came out. And I was really excited about running it. I'd made a kind of space station in an old ancient, like, set of ruins. That was somewhere, like, the idea was trying to be off on the border of the Romulan kind of space, because things are a bit more peaceful there now. This was before Star Trek Nemesis came out. And my brother met a fellow trolley boy at his work in the Lewis Road Sainsbury's, this guy called Ash, who was a big Trekkie, and my brother would alternate between gushing a bit about Star Trek and bullying him a bit because he was a big nerd. And my brother, being my brother, always loved an amount of having his cake and eating it, of being a nerd and judging people for being nerds. Yeah, you know, any kind of teenage moments of attempting to be cool always look rubbish in the rear view. But he was like, my brother's running a Star Trek RPG. You know everything about Star Trek and you need friends. Come and join us. And not a great pitch, but yeah, he was like, I will take this boy, this large boy, under my wing. And Ash joined us, and I immediately dropped the Star Trek game. I was like, I am not running Star Trek for an actual Trekkie. I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know most of this stuff. I'm going to get well actually to hell. Now, modern day Charlie would go, yes, obviously it's not canon. I'm running it. But yeah, as a teenager, again, I just couldn't bring myself to. I was terrified of the idea of actually running Star Trek for someone that knows what they're doing. Now, currently, I am that person in my group. Despite being a fairly casual, hence the name of this, Star Trek fan, I asked my group how much Star Trek had they seen, and it was a good selection between them. One of them had seen just the original series and Next Gen, one had just seen DS9 and Voyager, one had seen The Essentials, okay. And one had seen a couple of the movies. So, yeah, I was like, good, good. Open canvas to work with. That's all right. I already knew that.
Was the guy who only seen a couple of the movies the guy who was running the Alien campaign, who was not an Alien?
No, no. Different group. than that. But no, that was Arthur, who I figured, like, he's a game designer under their own right, but is often a bit of the pop culture touchstones that I have, they don't necessarily have.
Gotcha.
So yeah, but in this case, Star Trek Adventures. Ooh, I received this box set and started pouring through it and had to do a few bits of prep for it. So this box set, nice solid box. I vaguely remember the first edition box looking a little flimsy. But yeah, this is all very nicely done. Got a nice painting on the front, which is some of the pre-gen characters, because this has pre-made characters who are all kind of iconic characters, the same way D&D and Pathfinder have recurring characters, or at least they might still do, but like 3rd and 4th edition D&D definitely had these characters are the characters that keep popping up. Yeah, so this has the same sort of thing, even in alternate era cosplay in the start set rules of like, yeah, you've got the Tellarite in Enterprise uniform kind of thing, and the Helmsman in a TNG one. But yeah, this is it for the rules, which is quite nice. It's what, 48 pages, which is about as long as I like my rules to be anyway. It gets quite quickly into it, going, this is the 2d20 system. You roll 2d20s and you're aiming to get under a stat. So it comes with some nice light blue d20s, which they normally go for a thematic kind of color. Before, when they've gone, we sell yellow, blue, and red ones, I think the previous starter set were like, well, this is to match Kirk's nice kind of green top. I assume this is supposed to be like transporter blue or something.
Yeah, I think so, looking at the...
And it's got a lovely little... It's a little blurry on the camera, but that's right, because the audience at home can't see it. These lovely D20s have a Starfleet Delta on the one, because this is a roll-low system, which, for my group, who are incredibly unlucky at their dice rolls, is normally a good sign. You basically add an attribute like daring to a department, like security, daring and security. Boom! You put those stats together and try and roll equal to or under it on a couple of d20s. And you can add more d20s with something called momentum, or by giving me, the GM, something called threat, which I will always offer as an option, because why not? And that way you can actually hit difficulties of you need this many results underneath. And what's quite nice is all the characters have little focuses. So our engineer, Burke Venjaxa, a Tellarite, who was a bit experienced, bit gruff. He was good fun. He had reverse engineering, which felt like a power gamer move, focus-wise. It's like our pilot had concentration. So the player was always like, just wondering, could I use concentration for this? So, yes, I guess technically you're having to concentrate. Or computers, again. Like, I love that for power gaming isn't, oh, I've got this broken feat that allows me to slice through all these things. No, it's just that I'm really good at reverse engineering things. the nerds with it all. And that means that you're, like, normally if you roll low, good. If you roll a one, it's two successes. It's a crit. Yay. But if you've got a focus, your crit range increases to your department. So if you're doing security and daring, and you've got a security of 5, any roll of a 5 or under is now a critical as well. So you end up with this kind of negotiation from the players, because I don't keep track of what their focuses are, of going, yeah, you know, that sounds like reason and science. And they'd go, cool, can I use reverse engineering maybe with that? And I'm a nice GM. You know, so most of the time I'd either go, yeah, or how? Like, what's that look like if you're doing that? They go, well, because it's ancient technology, isn't it? So I need to have a look at these things and figure out the pattern backwards from there. And I like that, that you get this framing, and in a way, just mentioning I'm doing my spreadsheet nerd Starfleet bit, it's kind of, it gives it some weight in the fiction. It gives it some drama where a lot of the time in RPGs, fighting is the drama.
Yeah.
And there are fighting rules. They're not big, which is good. That's normally a red flag for me in Star Trek. Like, Star Trek board games, if they are all about the fighting, why is it a Star Trek board game? But yeah, we had like two fights, I think, in this. Maybe three. That's out of six sessions that we played with the game, which was cool. We had this lovely campaign book, which, again, nice, pretty cover. This is longer than the rule book, and I quite like that. It's basically three adventures and three what they call mission briefs. And the three adventures are linked together. The first one's a bit hand-holdy and starts a little dramatic, which is great for, like, in media res kind of stuff, but also immediately caught me off guard for, but this is Star Trek, though, guys. Be careful with this, because you've got this floating city above a Jovian planet, and creatures coming out of rifts, and oh my god, it's all a disaster. So the group beam down and are having to get refugees off site, and immediately the first encounter is these weird, almost plant-like, weird interdimensional things. I was like, oh fuck, is it starting a Star Trek campaign with a fight? That doesn't feel right. And immediately the doctor we had in our group, Dr. Varal, a Vulcan who has kind of learned through some encounter with a space god thing, emotions do have value. And she likes the idea of them. She just doesn't do them. She ran, charged out to rescue some people. The engineer was like, I'm going to engineer some shit. That was our Tellarite guy. And the third player that we had was a pilot, a helmsman, who was basically backup security because no one took the security character. Same with the ensign, that was a bit of dabbling with stuff. So the two of them were kind of, okay, can we stun these things and get people to safety? But I like that they framed it a lot more in that style of, no, we're protecting these people, we're keeping this safe.
Did the pilot concentrate really well on shooting?
Oh, yeah, concentrated so well on so much of this. Like, he got to do some hotshot piloting as well, which is great, because he had values which were, like, basically Fast and Furious. Like, if any character could relive Fast and Furious in Star Trek, it would be, what is it, Lieutenant Junior Grade Rashid Kamal, who was basically, is it, the need for speed was one of his values. It's like, guy, come on. He had a pastime of skateboarding. Everyone's got a pastime. Like, the Commodore who's in charge had Dom Jot as hers. So, yeah, it was quite nice seeing, you know, I used some of the more Gauntlet-style framing-the-scene sort of things of before a hell from someone comes in, everyone narrate to me in a little montage what your character's up to on the ship. And people would refer to either their pastimes or when we gained another player that was our security chief, he was all either serious on mission or creating some poetry. So yeah, the characters had depth, had things going on, even though they were pre-made. And I like that. It keeps that attitude I have in general of Star Trek of, this isn't just the Enterprise, every ship's got this nonsense. Like, the pre-gen Commodore is a Trill who insisted she'd never be joined, but she had an encounter with her future self who was joined and had to take that Trill and now has future knowledge. And a secret Symbiont. And so, yeah, sure, why not? Okay, and that was all kind of neat. But yeah, and the other big thing with this disaster scenario was an extended task, which is how you go, okay, we've got a problem, how do we fix it? And the Star Trek RPG does a really nice job of that, of going, you got these boxes, the players check them off by doing things. Like, they determine how they're fixing it. So it's like, get these people off of here. And each player goes, right, I'm taking their cargo transporters and using that. I'm using the public radio systems to communicate to people and guide them through. You know, all of these kind of things. So whatever they're doing that they can use their talents in can work towards it, which is lovely. And there are these breakthroughs. So at one point in one of the games, the group were trying to find someone. And the first breakthrough, a certain amount of success is of like canvassing a place, looking through security records, anything like that. They would get a lead. So whatever they did at that point, metacurrency-wise, they could get themselves a lead to this merchant. And then once they hit this later point, finding the merchant store, poking around it, the anti-shoplifter things in the store will go off because the merchant caught wind that they were going to his store and has booked it. And it's lovely. It's a really nice thing. Now, I know some GMs would be like, oh no, there has to be the exact answer. It's like, no.
No.
No. Like, I love the Doctor Who RPG, actually, of all things, taught me this. Present them with problems, present them with tools. They'll figure it out. They're smart. Like, they will find a cool way of doing these things. And that should be rewarded rather than you followed the girl skipping along doing the Alan Moraine song precisely to my demands, the all-encompassing GM and all that. So it was really nice seeing the players figuring that kind of thing out, even though a couple of times they could get a little stumped. And like, the campaign itself is fine. It's all about these creatures, Bryozoans from the 12th dimension. And the first scenario is disaster recovery. The second scenario is, that's where I was in when I was reading this. I was like, here's my spreadsheet nerd shit. They've got an asteroid belt to look at. Yeah. It's got some metals in it. And those metals, they're weird. So they were looking at the metals, and the Bryozoan things like attacked the ship because some sabotage had been done to the ship somehow by one of the people they'd rescued. Oh dear. And there was stuff going on with the warp core. There was stuff going on with gradonic radiation. Yes, made up radiations and metals and things. And the group had to figure out how to communicate with these things that were, one, an ex-hive mind that had been forced into being a hive mind again and were freaking out about it. And, like, two, communicated through gesture. It was weird. And brilliant. And the warp core nearly blew up. The ship nearly blew up. That was our most dangerous session. And it was the spreadsheet nerd session, where the main thing was, we need to communicate with these things and go, oh, fuck, we're really sorry. Let's get you back in there. And also remove the sabotage bits on our ship. And that was brilliant. And then we had absences. We had almost every single session a different roster of players. So we gained the security chief, an Andorian called Thravik, played by a friend of mine, Gihan, who came along to join the rest of us. And we did a mission brief, which is basically like a one-page, one-shot thing. And I've seen mission briefs for Star Trek Adventures before. They're a nice idea, and I wasn't sure how well they'd work as just like, here's a character's log that you give to whoever's in focus, because each one rotates. So give this to the security chief, and they'll read out basically the mission briefing, which is quite nice. And then here are the dramatic beats. Here's some supporting casts. Here's a vague idea of a conclusion and some side stuff. And they are really good. Like, their first one, they'd been co-opted by Starfleet Intelligence, Section 31, to, oh God, and I had to warn them not to bother watching the movie. I was like, if you're interested in Section 31, don't. Just don't watch the movie. That will not help. Yeah, and they had to find a Klingon defector who had technology for this Starfleet Intel guy. And again, they had to canvas neighborhoods. They had to do all these things. So it was a bit of a chase. Thravik's player, Gihan, pretty much used every single different weapon he could, might have accidentally disrupted a Klingon to death. Yeah, luckily Starfleet Intel just kind of wiped that bit out. But also, as a GM, I learned with that my metacurrency of threat increases whenever they do anything that with lethal force. If they use phasers to stun, brilliant, use phasers to stun. If they use phasers set to kill, if they use a disruptor, I generate threat, which is quite neat. Like, I can use threat to add dice to my pools, and I can use threat to do bad things. And there are these little tokens, incredibly flimsy tokens. Like, if I run this as a campaign, these are getting replaced with either poker chips or something plastic, because they are thin. Like, I play a lot of board games, and these are thin even for board game kind of level things. But yeah, the players also have their side for it, which is nice, and has a maximum of 6, because you spend them by, you get them by overachieving. This is Star Trek, so you got a lot of overachievers, you know? So having it max out is really good, because my players in their first session were way too polite. They were like, oh, do you mind if I use this? Oh, no, I won't use any, thanks. So I'd offer, you know, do you want to spend any momentum to add dice to that roll? It's like, no. Even in the last session, the engineer of the group was like, I'll spend one momentum to get one dice. And I was like, you could spend more. Do you want to spend more? It's like, no, one's all right. But it's a really nice idea that you've got this group currency that the players can add to. Because we had, in our third session, you have an action archaeology scene and a space scene where the group are trying to deal with some Nausicaans in a weird nebula with tendrils of cosmic space going on and moons. And the group are basically trying to vamp for time on the ship and go, we can't start an interstellar incident. We've had wars with the Klingons, wars with the Gorns. We do not want a war with the Nausicaans as well. But also, we need to play for time while our archaeology guys are doing shit. So you've got this back and forth play between halves of the group, with the ones on the planet doing extended action of trying to archaeology their way out of a problem, and up in space going, look, we're going to barrel roll. We're going to get out of the way of any of their shots. We're going to, like, the captain's regrouping and trying to figure out how we're dealing with this shit. But the Nausicaans are like, heretics, you're on holy ground here. So, well, it's holy ground from people you might have helped drive extinct, but yeah, sure.
Sure.
We'll just vamp for time until we get our guys back up. And we know you've got your guys on the planet but can't say, and we've got our guys on the planet and can't say. So let's all just be tactful. It was very good fun watching that. And the guys on the ship, like, some of the players admittedly didn't have the most to do, but there are roles that you can do by default to just generate momentum. So the guys on the ship were not only able to deal with the Nausicaans, but to generate momentum for the guys on the planet to then spend to save the day. It was a really interesting experience, I think. If I ran it as a series, I'd alternate between doing my own big episodes and the mission briefs, because not only do they have tons of those, but the stories themselves were fine. But when I was chatting to my players, the mission briefs were where it shone.
Gotcha.
And personally, like, as an improv heavy GM, I think that probably helped that it allowed me to play a bit faster and looser, both with Star Trek lore and with what the stories were saying I was doing. I did also make a Garth of Izar reference in it, but it didn't go nowhere. But yeah, so far, like, playing Star Trek Adventures, I think from my experience of the Last Unicorn Games version and reading the Decipher version before, drama got rid of all of that and that company as a whole, this was the most Star Trek feeling Star Trek RPG that I've run. I think my group would definitely enjoy making characters for it, because having bought the core book, it's got a life path system. And I love a life path system, and getting to go with the players. Where was your character raised? What are their hobbies? Ooh, what's their experience?
I'm just imagining you trying to play Traveller.
Fuck no, sorry. I've read some of Traveller. I am an art game indie wanker. You know, I got to paint the scene with my guys because one of the mission briefs didn't mention any details about the location. And I've still got, as we've covered in Casual Trek, the idea of going, why just make their colonies and outposts look like 20th century Earth or anything? Pick other things. So I picked Regency Bath for one of them. Was it for their outpost on Axanar? So they got to swan around some nice Regency places and some nice Bridgerton looking buildings, and have tea with a guy with like their wall of hunting equipment that was all from different species. Like, oh yes, this Nausicaan blade that I got from someone. Clue. Or an Orion pet shop dealer who was basically accidentally selling these bryozoan entities. And the guys had to go to him like, mate, these are sentient. You really shouldn't be selling sentient beings. And he was like, oh, fuck, what? What? Oh, my God. Oh, that's awful. I didn't realize that was what I was doing. So, yeah, but in a top hat. And all that, because nice theming. So yeah, it was a really fun time. I think the thing itself is like 25 quid.
Okay.
And the core book itself is pricey and big. And while I did need to refer to it twice for Section 31 guy stats, I think ship stats, oh, shuttlecraft stats. The campaign book does cover like, it doesn't give shuttle stats, but it fudges over that. And the other things are nice to have rather than essential to have. So it can be run for, I think, a good solid six sessions, maybe a little more if people are hamming it up a bit more. But yeah, for like 25 quid, that's a really nice deal.
Yeah.
I mean, there were some issues here and there system-wise. Those I will get into in my review on whodaresrolls.com, where I will bore everyone rather than just Miles about this. There will be links in the show notes. Yeah, personally, this is the kind of thing I can see myself doing again. If we ever get to doing anything a bit more streamy, it would be interesting to try running it for yourself and others as well. As I could see that being a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah. Thank you for telling us about 12-dimensional assholes.
Oh, my God. Like, the bryozoans themselves had it, like, they had it rough. Those poor things. Like, when, in the finale, when they end up getting broken out again, I did end up playing it just exasperated. Just like, what? Again? Again, we've only just got back to the 12th dimension. Guys, like, we're a hive mind again. We didn't want this. We voted to not be a hive mind. Why do you keep doing this? And they're like, we're really sorry. We didn't want this either. Like, yeah. Oh, dear. I was very happy that even with my group's extremely mixed experience of Star Trek, they managed to do a Starfleet really well.
Good.
Like, even they were surprised at some points. Like, our guest star player, Gihan, who popped in late into it, finished his first session, I think his second session of it, going, I thought we were going to have a fight. I thought there was going to be violence here. But it was music. We solved it using music, using UB40, weirdly. I can't remember why.
Okay, that was the case, fair enough.
Sure, that was in the Regency place as well. It was a weird mix, but it worked. And I was like, yeah, this is Star Trek, bitches. Like, you get to solve these things with knowledge and research and doing things like that. So well done. Good on you all. So yeah, I'm very proud of what, Lee, Mark, Vinny, Arthur, and Gihan as my players for letting me trek out like a proper nerd. I was given this when I left my old job. I was given a notepad, which is a little captain's log one, that it's too small for casual trek. Like, I was given it specifically with the, you can use this for notes for casual trek, and it's tiny. But for the RPG, it was perfect. So yeah, it was a lovely time. If you want a lovely time, come back to us for casual trek. And yeah, if you want a lovely time with role-playing in a Star Trek environment, then do a Star Trek Adventures. It's at Modiphius's site and God knows, like, so many other places. Just don't go to Amazon for it.
No.
It'll be cheap, but, you know, we don't want to encourage them. So, next time, we'll do something Star Trek-wise. Who knows what, because I'm not sure when this one's airing. So, you can find us on ko-fi.com/casualtrek and on Blue Sky at casualtrek.bsky.social. Mars, where can folks find you?
They can find me on Blue Sky at marsreedlobato.bsky.social and on my, at the moment, currently rather neglected blog at mareedlobato.wordpress.com.
Ah, you can find me in issue 2 of Sprigs and Kindling, where I've provided a little extra unseen for the role-playing game The Between, about the building of the London Underground, and also on fakedtales.com, where I talk about comics and RPGs mainly. So yeah, that's it from us. Go do a Starfleet, even if you do roll badly.
And roll 2d20 to eat a jelly baby.
Oh. Fuck. I failed.
Okay, Charlie, the jelly baby eats you.
Oh no!
You have been listening to Casual Trek, a Nerd and High podcast, presented by Charlie Etheridge Nunn and Miles Reed Lobato. Music by Alfred Etheridge Nunn. Star Trek by Paramount. Not us. Not yet.